I'll get there. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children, can I have your attention, please? Thank you so much. I'm Dr. Fuchs. I am delighted on behalf of the Faculty of Medicine, the universities, and many of my colleagues to welcome you all to the Mini Health Sciences series and symposium. As I asked you last time, how many are CGIP students? Great. How many are high school students? Wonderful. A nice mix. How many of you were not here last week? Super. So we have new attendees, and I'm delighted. And remember that, because we have room in the hall, registration is still open. So if you like the lecture, go home tonight, email your friends, tell them to register, because all our speakers, and me as well, we love a full house. So we've got lots of room, so bring on your friends. We want them all to learn about McGill and health sciences. As I explained to those of you who were here last week, we explicitly call this health sciences and not medicine because we want to emphasize the fact that the healthcare professions have an array of specialties, an array of professional streams, an array of talents and skills. And in today's healthcare environment, each one of those persons is necessary. Each type of professional is necessary to the welfare and healing of our patients. And so we're very pleased to give you the full array. As I mentioned last week, several of the speakers are physicians, and many are not. And that's important. So last week we heard from Dr. Amir Raz, who is a psychologist by training, who talked about cognition and cognitive science. And today we'll hear about another aspect of healthcare. Before I introduce the speaker, a couple of ground rules. First, you see on the back the sponsors, and we always thank them. Then we have a slide that if you are watching online, live streaming, you can send in your questions to that email address, and we will get them. As you know, who were here last year, that if you have questions, and many of you had wonderful questions, you write them down on the cards, and you give them to one of our volunteers, who are students wearing red McGill shirts. So at the end of the lecture, scribble down your question, hand it over, they'll bring them all down, and we'll select questions for the speaker. Second is the tour. Now we got to go back. Here you go. Don't move. There is a special event with a McGill open house this coming weekend. It's your chance to go into the buildings, see the labs, meet people, ask questions. Maybe you do an experiment, I'm not sure. But you can look at cells, you can look at people, you can look at equipment. And it's very exciting. And we have special guests who will be speaking on what it is to be an astronaut. Sounds pretty neat. And that's, as you can see, in the Leacock building, which is the one on the main campus, at 11 in the morning. And then you can spend the rest of the day visiting different schools and faculties. How many of you went on the MNI tour? Anybody here? Okay. How many enjoyed it? That's great. More people enjoyed it than went. That's great. There's always an error in statistical sampling. You just proved it. So, we are not having any more of those tours, not because they weren't good, but I guess the timing just proved difficult because you have to finish school and do what you have to do and get to the MNI. But nonetheless, you can still go visit. It'll be part of Open House, so we encourage you to participate in Open House and learn about a lot more things. A couple of more ground rules. You are so enthusiastic, and you're all great students, that half of the room flocked to the front of the hall at the end of the talk last week, which is great. Except the speaker also worked all day, and he's generally a little older than you, so they get tired, my colleagues. So they can't stay all night even though they'd love to. So we finished the question period around 8 o'clock. You're welcome to come down and ask questions, but at 8:15, the speakers turn into pumpkins. That's it, right? And we take them home, or we let them go home. So just to conserve their energy, and you're very enthusiastic, so do come on down. But remember, we can't keep the speakers here a long, long time because they do have other obligations and they have to leave, but they love to talk to you. Second, when you do come down, don't ask the speakers for interviews. They can't grant interviews to everybody who wants them. I know you're all doing projects. That's terrific. But if you really want to email any of the speakers, you can look up their bios on the website, the reading materials. You can email the speakers. They won't mind that. They may not be able to answer all of them, but you can certainly email and ask questions. And when they're up here, don't ask to volunteer in their lab or with their research. Send them an email. They can accommodate a lot of you. There's a tremendous enthusiasm. So we want to make sure that as many people get opportunities as possible, but you have to realize that the opportunities are not endless. So we love to have you here. We love to have you down here, but we need to kind of control the enthusiasm just a tiny bit. We certainly don't want to dampen it. It was great, and your questions last week were fabulous. Today we shift to another aspect of health sciences, namely nursing. One of the earlier titles of Dr. Clark's talk was, you know, the new world of nursing, or the world of new nursing beyond Florence Nightingale. So nursing respects its origins in the care for patients that Florence Nightingale exemplified, and her understanding not only of care for patients, but she was really a pioneer in public health. She opened windows, brought in fresh air, got rid of infection, cleaned the sheets, all of it having to do with the welfare of patients and the quality of their care. So Dr. Clark, Sean Clark, our speaker tonight, who is a member of the School of Nursing, his own research deals with precisely that, the quality of care for patients. And it's quality of care that makes a huge difference. There was a report that came out in the late 90s from the Institute of Medicine in the United States that showed 100,000 people a year die in the United States because of errors in hospitals and healthcare facilities. Not because people are stupid, but people make mistakes. We're all human. So quality control is important. That's what Dr. Clark studies. His background is in nursing here at McGill. He got his PhD in nursing, probably one of the earliest graduates in our doctoral program, which was a new program at the time. Once he finished that work, he went on to Philadelphia, and he worked in their system of healthcare and was interested in what causes people in the healthcare environment to have accidents, get stuck with needles, sometimes they're infected, staff will get stuck with needles, have a risk of hepatitis, so it's a serious question, medication errors, and so on. He then went on to work at Toronto in the University Health Network. And several years ago, we were delighted to recruit Dr. Clark back to McGill, to his alma mater, to take on the Susan E. French Chair in Nursing Research and Innovative Practice. And that's what he'll talk to us about tonight. So he's a real leader in the field, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy his perspective on nursing, how it's evolved, and what quality control means, and how research in the field of nursing can help our patients get better care. Dr. Clark.
Thank you so much. Good evening. It's really an honor to be here this evening. Thank you very much, Dr. Fuchs, for the kind introduction. Thank you to the organizers of the event for having me. I think this is the first time that nursing has been part of many health sciences. Hopefully this won't be the last time we are. I'm really looking forward to talking to you tonight about my profession, nursing, and giving you some new perspectives on what nursing is about. What I'd like to do tonight, just to give you a bit of a preview of what the talk is going to look like, most of my talk is going to look like, I think, what some other speakers have done, which is give a new perspective on a health sciences topic. Only I'm going to talk about what nurses do instead of about hypnosis or sports injuries or eating disorders. A big part of what I'd like to do tonight, though, because I know in the audience we have future pharmacists, physicians, physical therapists, occupational therapists, and nurses. And even if you don't end up becoming health professionals, you will be customers or clients of the healthcare system. So I'm going to take the opportunity to maybe educate you a little in what nurses do that goes beyond some of the things that you might have heard before. I was also told to go very light on the recruiting, and so I promise you I won't do a hard sell recruiting job tonight, but I'll do a little bit, and you can always feel free to ask me questions afterwards. So what I'm going to try to avoid in this talk, because you're all smart folks from high schools and CEGEPs around the region, I'm going to avoid giving you a talk that's about the softer, sentimental, sort of warmer, emotional side of things. Not that I don't like cute babies, not that I don't think that teddy bears aren't great and that caring isn't a good thing, but I'm going to sort of move us into a different zone, and I'm going to talk a little more about some of the practicalities of what nursing is about. I'm not going to give you a slick sales presentation and try to tell you that you need to sign up for nursing school now, call 1-800, and we'll throw in a free toaster. I am not going to give you a presentation about media images of the nurse, although I'll tell you that for a thesis, for an undergraduate thesis topic, a high school media project, fascinating, because nurses are one of the largest groups of predominantly female workers in our society, and it's just fascinating what people have done with this image over time. But I'm not going to focus on that tonight. A few more caveats. I know that there are some folks from the Ingram School in the audience, some students, but this is a presentation for you guys as outsiders to our profession. And it's not a presentation for nurses. And so I'm not speaking for all 300,000 nurses in the profession, because not everybody has the same perspectives on everything. I'm also not going to mention every single kind of nurse out there. I'll crack a joke about it in a little bit. And I'm going to make some broad statements, although I think I'm going to cover the ground. Nurses are in a lot of places in the healthcare system. And I am going to mention nurses' work with other disciplines like medicine, but I'm not primarily going to talk about those other professions. So when I talk about what nurses do, I'm not going to imply that nurses are the only healthcare workers who interact with patients, who provide hands-on care, who teach patients and families about things they need to know in order to look after themselves, or coordinate care or advocate, but I am going to primarily talk about my own profession. So if you know, if you have sisters, brothers, family members, friends who work in the health professions other than nursing, and you see something that I'm going to say and you say, but my dad does that and he's a surgeon, I'm not trying to debate that. So, for starters, nurses are the largest group of healthcare workers in most industrialized countries. So when I say most, I mean Canada, the US, the UK, France, and so forth. There are some countries, though, like Spain and Italy, that actually have more physicians than nurses. But this is really the exception to the rule. It's because of the way the history went on. In most countries, like Canada and the States, nurses outnumber physicians by about 10 to 1. Nurses, as such a large group, are the first point of contact that most consumers of healthcare have. Whether we're talking about in clinics, emergency rooms, whether we're talking about who you'll see the most of if you spend time in a hospital. Again, not saying that we're the only folks out there, but I'm saying that in a lot of cases, we'll be the first people that you see. Pretty much anywhere healthcare is being delivered, you'll find nurses. So here's my crack about, before we get there. The classic image of the nurse, of course, is a nurse who works in a hospital. This is a photograph of a post-anesthesia care unit where patients come after surgery to be looked after until they fully come out of the effects of anesthetics, when they need to be watched over very closely before they go back to a place where there's not as many staff to look over them. The deal with hospitals, I'm going to talk about 60% of nurses work in hospitals. But as I said in the previous slide, nurses work everywhere. So we could spend the whole hour just listing nursing's different specialties and practice areas. And this is the one crack about how many different places that nurses work in. There was a series of books back around World War II that was actually, it was a mystery series for children. And it was intended to sell the idea of nurses in war, like of going to nursing school in wartime. It was a mystery series. Cherry Ames actually was a nurse and a detective sleuth, kind of a Nancy Drew type. They, of course, had books, Cherry Ames, student nurse, and then she became a staff nurse and eventually a chief nurse, I guess. But the series was about all of these different places she worked. My personal favorite is Cherry Ames, department store nurse. I'm not exactly sure what a department store nurse does, but perhaps in the day that's what that went on. A less glamorous place that you might not immediately think you'd find nurses is in some community settings. This is actually a still image from a film that you can get on YouTube. If you put in the words Bevel Up documentary, you'll pull this up on YouTube. Fascinating documentary about nurses who work in Vancouver with homeless and intravenous drug user patients who are at high risk for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV infection, who have a lot of things going on in their lives, shall we say, contact with illegal activities, physical risks, harms, physical harms of risks of physical harm, mental illness, and so forth. This movie is about this really interesting way that nurses use their knowledge, and we're going to talk about the science and so forth in a moment, use relationships that they've built to try to keep these patients as healthy as possible on the street. And it's absolutely fascinating to watch. So what do nurses do? The topic of the talk tonight. A first answer would be, and this is a definition I really like, nurses provide support and information for patients and their families that they would probably do for themselves if they had the knowledge, skill, and opportunity or circumstances. The deal is that we have a healthcare system, we have treatments we're going to talk about that are so effective and yet so have so many side effects and so many dangers that frankly you can't expect somebody who hasn't had special training to be in a position to help patients deal with a lot of the circumstances that they're going to run into. Often the work that nurses do is around physical and mental health crises, life transitions, things like having a new baby come into a family or moving into a long-term care facility if one becomes too physically or mentally disabled to stay in the community, or decisions about attempting to stay healthy. Another answer to the question, what do? Nurses tend to work on making sure the environment around their patients is physically, psychologically, and clinically safe. And we're going to get at that. That's an area that I do research on, as Dr. Fuchs was saying. It's a really important part of how nurses use their background. They carry out treatment plans that are decided upon, usually in a group between the patient, the physicians, the other health professionals. They also spend a lot of time watching what unfolds with patients, how conditions change over time, and whether patients are getting better as expected, whether they're getting worse and things need to be changed, whether the unexpected is happening and requires people to jump in. A colleague of mine, actually, she's actually a personal friend. Her name is Suzanne Gordon, and if you Google her, you'll find all kinds of interesting stuff. She's not a nurse, but she's a journalist, and she's been writing about nursing for almost 30 years now. And she gets to write about nursing probably in a way that's a little more dramatic than we feel comfortable doing. She wrote a little piece that's made the rounds on the internet talking about how she sees what nurses do. She talks about protection and rescue. That nurses protect patients from the risks and consequences of illness, disability, and infirmity, as well as from the risks of treatments of illnesses. They protect patients from the risks that occur when illnesses make it difficult, if not impossible, even dangerous, lethal, for patients to perform things like breathing, turning, going to the toilet, coughing, or swallowing. So there's all kinds of interesting things in there that we're going to pick up on. And she also talks about that sort of emotional support side of things, which I guess is where the teddy bears and all that stuff tend to come from. She says even the most emotional work that nurses do is a form of rescue, that nurses form relationships with patients and help them be less afraid, less socially isolated, and they help patients and their families deal with what it means to be sick and what it means to especially be sick in the long haul. So she says, and this is almost a bumper sticker slogan, nurses save lives, prevent complications, prevent suffering, and save money. Call 1-800. It has a nice ring to it. But in terms of getting a flavor, I realize we're going to get more specific in a moment. Nurses work everywhere in the healthcare system. They have clients basically from the time they're born to old age, all the ages in between. They work in settings where we see patients sometimes for a few minutes at a time. They sometimes work with patients in settings where they stay for months, years, decades even. They work with individuals, and that's sort of the classic view of the nurse, but they also sometimes work with families. They work with groups, for instance, in the workplace or in the community. And sometimes the patient of a nurse is actually a whole community as nurses and others try to figure out what needs to be done in a particular community to help people in it stay safer or be healthier, for instance, to do things to help people get more exercise or eat more healthily or stop smoking or whatever. The profession of nursing, which goes back, as Dr. Fuchs says, the nursing goes back as a profession to Florence Nightingale. I didn't put a slide of her, the lady with the lamp. Maybe you guys don't see that stuff anymore. It's not in the books that you read or get in school. She founded our profession about 150 years ago. The work that nurses do has been done since the beginning of the time, of time. All of the things that when people are sick need to be done, all of the things that need to be done to support a treatment plan and deal with the side effects that may go along with it. The work will always be needed. So I'm briefly going to make a distinction that maybe might not seem important on the surface to you, but it actually is in the end. Because nursing work, a lot of the stuff, at least on the surface, doesn't necessarily look as if it takes a lot of scientific knowledge, a lot of skill or training, it's important to get into the space where you can understand why nurses might go to school for prolonged periods of time and why we might not want, in certain settings, people who don't actually have in-depth training and so forth. We have something called regulation, and regulation of a profession is a set of limitations on who's allowed to do certain kinds of work and who's allowed to call themselves certain things. You probably heard the phrase, practicing medicine without a license. We don't let people go out in the field and pretend to be doctors and write prescriptions and so forth. Neither do we let people go out in the field and pretend to be nurses, to call themselves nurses or do some of the things that nurses do. Professions are specific kinds of work where people train for long periods of time, and then basically they enter into the fold after they finish their educations, they take certain exams, and then basically the other members of the profession, through offices and colleges and orders, they work to oversee and to make sure the things that those people are doing stay safe over the course of their career, and they correct problems that come up if there are complaints about the way the people do that work. When do we need regulation? We need regulation when the public would be endangered by unqualified people performing services. So we can talk about nursing work in the broadest sense, and sometimes friends, family, and so forth, volunteers, do some of the things that some nurses do some of the time. There are also people out there who, after a few dozen hours or perhaps some on-the-job training, they do paid personal care. They go and they sit with people who need somebody in attendance with them, or they'll help them move or get dressed or bathe or whatever. And in general, those people are not highly educated and they're not regulated. But then we move into a zone where people start doing things that require a little more education, a little more science, and where the stakes are higher. And then we get into different groups. We get into a group that you'd call practical or vocational nurses, or as we call them in Quebec, infirmières auxiliaires. And those are folks who go to school for around a year to 2 years, and they learn in a little less depth than registered nurses that I'm going to talk about in a second about various things that people need generally when they're sick or when they're in crisis or whatever. There's professional nursing, which is the sort of the big umbrella, and I'm going to talk about that mostly. And then there's something called advanced practice nursing, and that's professional nursing plus extra skills, I guess, that are even higher stakes. So here we put nurse practitioners, for instance, who are nurses who have gotten extra training to be able to add making diagnoses and making prescriptions to some of the things that they've learned when they were in their basic nursing training. Or also in this group of advanced practice nurses are specialists, who know a lot about particular kinds of problems, and they are in a position to bring in treatments, prescribe treatments, and follow through with patients more than maybe the average nurse might. So there are about 332,000, actually, if I do my rounding correctly, 333,000 regulated nursing workers in Canada there were in 2011. And these are numbers that actually just came out this month. And about three quarters of those are what you call registered nurses, who are folks that have about 3 years of education at some point after high school, being educated and looking after people of all ages with physical and mental health problems, also people trying to stay healthy and so forth. They are the biggest group. We have those practical nurses who are about 20%, so they go to school for a smaller period of time and they have responsibilities that are a little narrower. And then we also have a very small group out west of nurses who spend 3 years just studying how to look after people with emotional and behavioral problems. But we don't have those in Ontario and Quebec or out east for the most part. So registered nurses, that largest group, the group that I'm part of and that we do education for here at McGill, accounts for about 291,000 folks. And about 93% of people who have licenses, they actually practice nursing. They're out there working. Some hold on to their licenses afterwards for sentimental reasons after they retire. Or they go work in another field and they decide to hold on to their license just in case. The average age is pretty high, 45. And only 12% were under 30 in 2011. And about 40% were 50 and over. And that's a point we'll come back to a little later. You probably knew this, not tons of men in nursing, about 7% nationally, higher in Quebec, about 10%. About 9% got their education in other countries. As you might expect, with a profession that has a lot of women in it, we have a fair amount of part-time folks, about 41%. About 60% work in hospital settings. 86% do hands-on care. Some of them are researchers and teachers like me, but most of them, the vast majority, are actually doing hands-on care. And about half of them, almost half, in 2011, held university degrees of one kind or another. There are basically three paths to becoming a registered nurse in Quebec or in most of the other provinces. On the left-hand side is one path where right out of high school you can do a technical deck and you can get a diploma. It's a kind of diploma that used to be given from hospital schools. That's right, you actually went to a hospital for 3 years and at the other side you came out with a diploma and the ability to get licensed as a nurse. Now that education is done at a CEGEP. Right after that education, you go and take an exam and you become a nurse, and then you can go on afterwards to get a bachelor's degree if you want, and then after that a master's and a PhD. The most common path, and I think for most of you who might be thinking of nursing school or might have friends that are going to nursing school, is this middle path where you get a health sciences deck, studying different sciences for a couple of years, and then you come in and do 3 years here at McGill, for instance, or at Université de Montréal or another of the universities in the province, and you get a Bachelor of Science degree from where you can get a master's degree and so forth. There's another interesting pathway. The path to nursing is open even if you get past an initial undergraduate degree and you decided not to be a nurse. Here at McGill, we have the only program in the country where you can get your initial training as a nurse at the master's level. So you come with almost any deck and a non-nursing bachelor's degree, and you come in and at the same time you get a master's degree and you also get that basic clinical education and you get licensed. So these three things in red are called entry points, and they're the 3 points, and everybody takes the same exam to start practice, but obviously depending what credentials that you get at different points in time, your career looks kind of different. If you want to be a nurse practitioner, that generally happens at the master's level. PhD education is to become a researcher or a teacher in nursing, and that's we'll talk a little bit about that. I won't go into a lot of depth about my personal career because it's not all about me. It's really about you, right? But I had one of these non-traditional pathways. I studied psychology and biochemistry as an undergraduate, and I came to the master's entry program here. So I was at McGill for 3 years. I did almost all of my clinical training at the Montreal General. I did medicine, surgery. I spent time in cardiology, and I spent my last year in the medical intensive care unit at the Montreal General. And then I became a staff nurse in the coronary care unit at the Jewish General Hospital here in town. I decided early on that I wanted to pursue a research career, so I did a PhD. I was very lucky to be early on in to have a pathway sort of carved out for me, I guess. And so I studied. I learned how to do research that was about how cardiac patients run into problems if they're socially isolated or depressed. If on top of the physical health problems they have, they also have problems in their social and psychological lives. And I started to teach. And I've been teaching nursing now, in addition to doing research, for about 15 years. So I teach nurse. I've taught over time. I've taught students courses about how to interview patients and how to do physical examination. I've taught courses in how to look after adult patients who are sick with illnesses either that require surgical treatment or are treated with by other means. And then for the last probably about 10 years in Pennsylvania, in Toronto, and probably here at McGill, I teach what they call professional issues in nursing and legal issues and policy, which is all of the things that nurses need to know in addition to all those skills in order to begin their practice. Along the way, I also picked up some training as a nurse practitioner in critical care. That's one of the first things I did when I went down to Pennsylvania. And so I learned some additional skills that nurses can use to be a little more independent in working with physicians in critical care units. And then I decided to get more education. You can see how my parents thought I was never going to finish school. Because it just went on and on and on. You don't have to go on and on and on. But there are those opportunities out there. And over time, I came to actually get into training researchers in nursing and other areas and leading research groups and so forth. Again, my career is highly atypical. I've had students say to me, like what you do, would never want to do that myself. That sounds like way too long a pathway. That's great. The cool thing about nursing is that there are many different paths that come off it. My classmates, they do amazingly varied and different things. I have a classmate who is the director of a long-term care facility on Long Island in New York State. I have a colleague who is a street nurse, like I was showing you before, and now she's a nurse practitioner out on the West Coast. My wife, who I met in nursing school, is a clinical specialist in wound and skin care, and so she looks after patients who have interesting wounds that are difficult to treat. And you'll see a little bit of her practice in a few slides. And I have a colleague who works at one of the CLSCs, one of the local community health clinics, and she's a nurse psychotherapist. I mean, that's quite a range of folks of different roles, and the versatility of nursing careers is really quite striking. There is less and less such a thing as a typical nurse. This slide is a slide of the graduating class from Wellesley Hospital in Toronto, a hospital that no longer exists. But back in the days of hospital schools, and you can see they're sort of all lined up nicely wearing the same uniform. This is a slide of the entering class from the University of California, San Francisco, which is one of the leading programs for graduates of bachelor's programs in other fields, the master's entry program in nursing. And you can see there that they may all be wearing the same thing, the snazzy green scrub tops and the nice white pants, but they are a range of genders, cultural backgrounds, and even ages. So there is less and less, even though we are, you know, sort of still a highly gender imbalanced, if you want to put it that way, profession, there is less and less such a thing as a typical nurse, and people from all different backgrounds find their place in our work. So coming back to what nursing is, I would say, and some nursing professors wouldn't like this definition, nursing is the healthcare discipline that's concerned with the practicalities of delivering services, the rolling up the sleeves and figuring out what to do at any particular moment, again, in cooperation with the other health disciplines. And I think what distinguishes what nurses do, and I think many of you have seen nurses in action in different settings, but nurses tend to work with clients over more extended periods of time or on a more continuous basis relative to the involvement of other workers and professionals. To highly oversimplify, if you're a patient in a hospital, you'll probably see a nurse at least every hour of the time that you're in the hospital, perhaps less at night if they're letting you sleep. You might see your physical or occupational therapist once a day or a few times a week. You might see your physicians once or twice a day. Nurses tend to be the discipline that's more continuously present and is working to coordinate the different services that are going on. One very famous physician, author, called nursing the glue that holds together the healthcare system because we are so involved in the practicalities and in holding things together continuously. I'll put in a brief pitch for what nursing science and nursing research is. I know that people in my family and some of my friends were wondering, so what exactly do nurses do research about? And people still ask that question. I sit on a panel with the U.S. National Institutes of Health, and we review applications in nursing and related clinical sciences. What are these research projects about that nurses do? They study how people respond to health situations, basically, how people respond to illness, how people respond to changes in their lives, and they specifically look at what sort of things that we should be looking at. We're trying to follow patients over time, and they're looking at how patients react to when nurses go in and they do things on behalf of patients with other members of the healthcare team. Some nurse researchers, and I would be one of them, also look at the way care is organized. How many patients should be the maximum that any given nurse has to look after if they're all if they're fairly sick, if they're really, really sick, or whatever? Those kinds of questions. So nurses these days, and this has developed over the last few decades, nurses actually do research in these areas, and they draw from different sciences in order to get answers to those questions about the practicalities of delivering care. What do nurses do? Another way of talking about what nurses do is what nurses proudly call the nursing process, but you're going to say, nah, this isn't anything special. This is just the scientific method that we've had drilled into our head over and over again. Nurses tend to gather data about their patients, identify problems and issues, plan and sequence treatments, put them in motion, find out how the patient did, and revise the plans as necessary, just like, you know, sort of having a theory, generating hypotheses, gathering data, checking out whether the hypotheses are confirmed, and so forth. And other health professionals and other professionals in general actually do this. There is a thinking process involved in this. Sometimes we think of nursing primarily in terms of what nurses do, in terms of giving medications or giving blood or all those kinds of things, but there is a problem-solving process involved. In hospitals, some of the things that we most stereotypically think of nurses as doing, administering medications, which on the surface looks easy, but not so much, especially when you're doing this with large numbers of patients and the medications have side effects and dangerous aspects to them and can interact. Nurses interview and examine patients. Nurses take vital signs. Vital signs, those physical, those things like pulse, temperature, respiration, and so forth that give us a real clue about how stable or unstable patients are, whether they need immediate attention or not. They also, nurses in hospitals, all of those tubes and lines and drains that come out of patients as part of their treatments, nurses look after those. Those are some of the things we think about. Feeding and things connected with feeding. We get help from the nutritionists around this, but nurses often are involved in that, helping somebody eat without choking, helping make sure that they get enough in their system, or sometimes bypassing the normal way of swallowing going into the stomach and so forth by using tubes that go directly into the bloodstream or directly into the stomach or the gastrointestinal tract. So this is a slide of a patient in a critical care unit. Critical care units are units where basically nurses are in constant attendance. If we tally up all the things that nurses are doing on behalf of a patient in most ICUs, it's somewhere between 16 to 24 hours of care per 24-hour period. So nurses are there constantly. In critical care units, patients are on the verge between life and death, and nurses are the constant presence. So along with physicians who specialize in critical care, who specialize in the treatment of life-threatening illness in the acute phase, nurses manage these patients. And you can see that this patient in particular, he has a tube in his throat that's helping him breathe. He's connected to what they call a ventilator that's helping him maintain his respirations. He also has a whole bunch of other lines, tubes, and so forth that are monitoring the pressures in his circulatory system and so forth, giving information that the health professionals need to make good decisions on an ongoing basis of what medications are needed when, and so on and so forth. A lot of nurses are drawn, a lot of people are drawn to working in critical care settings. It's not necessarily for everyone. Sort of this kind of intensity of treatment or this kind of, the kinds of situations, as you can imagine, there can be a lot of stress around this and dealing with people, families who are seeing their loved ones in this condition. And a lot of nursing students, they start nursing school thinking, ah, this is what I want to do. I want to be this kind of nurse. And that's great, and some people do. That's what I wound up doing. But you'll see, and we'll we'll talk about in a moment, that across the specialties now, pretty much all patients in hospitals are pretty sick. And there's a thinking process that's involved with all patients. And so critical care isn't the only specialty out there, and it certainly isn't the only one for any given student. So in addition to all those tubes, lines, drains, and all those things that you're doing for patients, compensating for things they can't do for themselves, there's thinking work that's really important. Why gather all that information? So you know how the patient is doing and whether they're on course or off course and whether things need to be changed about their treatment, and you know where each of your patients stands at any given moment. That's really, really, really important. Nurses also are responsible for picking up on complications as soon as possible. Something that I've studied in my research is this thing that happens sometimes where a patient is getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and people aren't realizing that that's happening. It's kind of like a car that's sliding gradually off a cliff, and they, you know, when we watch a movie with something like this, we're really hoping somebody's going to grab that car in time. That's what nurses do in a lot of settings. Sometimes it's in a hospital setting, and the patient is bleeding profusely, and nobody realizes it. But sometimes it's folks out in the community, and it's a family that's running into real problems. They're having trouble coping with something that's going on, and what might look to be a minor illness from the outside or a sudden set of crises going on, people getting out of work and so forth. The family's at a crisis point, and they need somebody to jump in and bring some services together to make sure things don't get worse. It's also complications in that sense. Nurses teach patients and families how to take care of themselves. And despite what you might see on TV, it's not just a matter of handing people a brochure and saying, hey, read this. Depending on what the patient has, how complicated the treatments that they're going to need to be involved in, how emotional or uncertain what they're dealing with is, they're going to need different kinds of information. And patients come in all shapes, sizes, backgrounds, and they want to know different things. Different things are particularly important to them. So you have to tailor the way that you teach according to your knowledge. You got to give patients good information because nothing makes patients angrier than giving them information that other people disconfirm. But after you have the right information to give them, you got to really figure out what methods, and it's usually more than one, to get that information in their hands. Nurses often refer patients to various services. They'll call the physicians back in. They'll call the rehab professions in to look in on a patient that has a problem that their expertise falls into. Also, because, as I was mentioning before, nursing is a really big tent of activities that includes a lot of different things, in a lot of cases, nurses are responsible for figuring out how to involve family and friends and volunteers and less trained people who may pop in and out, and figuring out which parts of nursing care can be safely taught to someone else and which things need to be really restricted to folks that have in-depth training. But it's an amazing thing, probably some of you have seen with family and friends. We send patients back into the community these days, hooked up to breathing tubes and intravenous lines and so forth. We can teach families to do a lot of things, and actually families are really resilient. But, of course, a lot of skill is needed. You can't teach people things that you don't know yourself, but you also have to be very sensitive to how that stuff looks. So I've been mentioning, making sort of a veiled reference to the hazards of medical care. Here's a quote that showed up in a patient safety book a while ago from the dean of one of the prominent UK medical schools. And I kind of like this quote. Medicine used to be simple, ineffective, and relatively safe. Now it is complex, effective, and potentially dangerous. I don't know if you have a sense of what this means. There used to be a time where we couldn't do a lot for a lot of our patients, that we would basically give what they called supportive care. We would stand back and watch as nature took its course. And if the patient was strong and had good luck, then maybe they'd get better, but maybe in some cases they really wouldn't, and we'd stand by and watch. Now, you know, probably the most prominent example is antibiotics, but we have treatments that are coming out all the time as a result of great science that's done at places like McGill and elsewhere. These treatments are fantastic. They can produce what we might actually call miracles in some instances. But in a lot of cases, there's a downside or a drawback or a danger. And the deal is that physicians and nurses and pharmacists and so forth need to come together to figure out how to make delivering those treatments a safe thing. So I just thought I'd throw out a little audience participation here, a sample question that a nurse who was newly graduated from nursing school might be asked on an exam. And I promise it won't be too complicated. I won't put any of you on the spot. But it'll give you a little scenario. A 68-year-old woman is diagnosed with thrombocytopenia. Anybody know what that is? low platelet count due to acute lymphocytic leukemia. So that's a blood cancer disease. She's admitted to the hospital. Where should the patient be placed? In A, a private room so she won't infect other patients and healthcare workers. B, a private room so she will not be infected by other patients or healthcare workers. C, a semi-private room so she'll have stimulation during her hospitalization. Or D, a semi-private room so she'll have the opportunity to express her feelings about her illness. Any thoughts? Do I have how many hands for A? Nobody for A. We're not worried about her infecting anybody because we know that leukemia is not contagious. B, how many for B? Okay, we have a significant number of Bs. Okay, C, and some Cs. And how about D? And some Ds. Okay. The correct answer is B. The deal is, I mean, and you have to know some things. You have to know quite a fair number of things in order to answer this question, but this is the kind of judgment that a nurse might actually make in her practice. The deal is, because in this blood cancer of leukemia, this lady has a low platelet count, which makes her at risk for bleeding, but she's probably also got some issues with her white blood cells not being produced that are getting in the way of her being able to fight infections. So she needs protection from everybody else. We don't need protection from her. But it's interesting, because C and D, there's a little bit of a grain of something in there that makes them not bad answers. We know, I'm a safety researcher, and some of my colleagues have done studies where we know that when we put a patient in protective isolation, for instance, to make sure they don't get infected, we know fewer people go in and see that patient, even if we make lots of gowns and gloves available. We know that patients can become really depressed and sad and anxious when nobody comes in to see them. We also know that they can be at risk sometimes for problems. So the whole element of isolation is important to consider and what the effects of isolation might be. But you need to know about a range of things, about a range of conditions, and what the implications are. So nurses' work is based on a scientific foundation, but nurses are educated in a different combination of sciences often and in different depths than the other health professions. We put a lot of emphasis before you come to nursing school and even during nursing school in understanding normal physical, psychological, and family functioning and how the body normally responds to disease. And we tend to study treatments like drugs and surgeries and so forth in terms of the expected responses the patients will have and also the risks that we need to watch out for and we need to know how to treat with the other members of the team. The science foundation that nurses get involved in tends to focus on common conditions and risk factors and presentations versus physicians who, for instance, study in a lot of depth, learning a whole range of things. Nurses generally would not tend to get all that educated in things that happen a few cases every 10,000 patients, for instance, whereas it might be quite important in the course of a physician's education to focus on some of that stuff. Details that help implement safe care. That's particularly important. So the anatomy, and the anatomy, for instance, that a nurse might study would involve knowing, if you're going to give an injection, how to get the right layer of skin or how not to hit a nerve, how to get the right, how to hit muscle and not hit bone or whatever. The basis of science that nurses get in their educations tries to lay the groundwork because treatments change over time. So we want people to understand enough of how the body works and what happens in disease so they'll have a lead on when new treatments get implemented. Something to keep in mind, though, that nurses have this wide open sort of tableau of things that they can do, but they specialize. And nurses who specialize often get very detailed knowledge of specific conditions. So in disease-oriented settings, like hospitals and clinics and so forth, in collaboration with physicians, pharmacists, and rehab professionals, nurses implement and adapt treatment plans. So they work together often, really in teams, literally in teams to do this. Nurses work with others to manage symptoms, sometimes with drugs, sometimes with counseling, sometimes with any variety of other things, positioning and so forth. They manage emergencies that come up when people are really sick, and those can be not only medical emergencies, but psychological emergencies. They help patients recover safely. Of course, our colleagues in the rehab professions, like PT, OT, and speech language, they know a lot about how you recover various kinds of physical and activity of daily life functioning and speech and swallowing capacity. But we're often very close partners because we're the ones that are with the patients on a lot more continuous basis, or we're seeing in the home, for instance, patients on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis. In the end, our goal is, with the members of the team, is to help patients and families live as well as possible in the long term. A question that's bound to come up, so like how are nursing and medicine different, and what's this business about medicine as a classic profession and so forth? And you know, if you were to study in social science, the sort of a hierarchy of professions, you'd hear people talk about what at least classically used to be known as the professions. Medicine, law, and the clergy were the classic professions. So these are professions that require postgraduate training. They tend to have, the practitioners of these professions have a lot of independence. They often work alone in theory, although nobody would probably say that today physicians work alone. They collaborate with colleagues and they work with other members of their own profession and other professions. One, there's a lot of education. Two, there's a lot of independence. And three, there's a lot of pay and prestige. And then you sort of go down the list and you'd say, well, there are some semi-professions out there that don't meet all these criteria in terms of education or prestige or whatever. And maybe nursing would get thrown in there along with things like social work and so forth. Maybe it would be, and then maybe we could go down and things sort of down the list and something like practical nursing or some of the technical occupations or trades would fall into this occupations or skilled labor group, and then underneath that we'd have folks that were unskilled labor, folks that came in and might be hired off the street or with limited on-the-job training. This is one way to look at work, and you might say, I want to be at the top of this pyramid. Understandable, and you actually, in some nursing courses, people get into, well, is nursing actually a profession or not? Why nursing might not be a classic profession? Well, the fact that it is so much about hands-on applied work. The fact that, remember that slide when I showed you those three pathways to become a nurse? There's three distinct ways to become a nurse. There's only one MD degree. There's only one kind of law degree, and for the most part, clergy members of the clergy have a single kind of training to come into that. Also, as I mentioned, there's a lot of different activities in there, and some, at least on the surface, may not look as if they require a particular amount of training. But this approach to thinking about work isn't the dominant one so much anymore. There's another approach out there that thinks about what the public needs in terms of people who are hired to do different things. And basically they say that social needs and technologies create markets or opportunities for different kinds of workers. So we have a society now, we have a medical care system that has a lot of intense treatments, patients that are particularly ill. We have families that are far flung across cities and countries and so forth, that aren't necessarily in a position to care for patients and so on and so forth. Needs and technologies change over time. And as things change and evolve, what people do in different professions or different occupations changes over time, too. And sometimes there's what you call entrepreneurship, people sort of reaching out and saying, aha, I'm a nurse, but I think we could do this area, or I, as a nurse, could do this area of care safely, and I'm going to try and negotiate it out with the physicians and the other people on my team in my hospital to do that. And then across the profession, people start doing that. And then sometimes there's pushback around that from the people who started doing whatever it was in question. And that's what's going on, for instance, with nurse practitioners. Nurse practitioners who, across Canada, the U.S., and the world, are starting to get into some of the territory that physicians used to keep for themselves. So that historical perspective, at one time, only physicians took blood pressures. Only physicians used stethoscopes, and I would say until the 1980s, nurses who used stethoscopes pretty much only used them to take blood pressures. At one time, drawing blood was something only physicians did. And over time, that changed. The armamentarium, if you want, all of the treatments that are given, the complexity, the diagnostic maneuvers, the treatments that are given, and the judgment that's required, and the science that's involved in imaging and so forth, these tasks became less important to the work of physicians, and nursing sort of took them on over time. And as technologies evolve, other things sort of join the list. And there are things that used to be done exclusively by registered nurses and now are done by other groups. Another thing to keep in mind is that even within professions, things change. At one time, there was no such thing as a respiratory therapist, somebody who specializes in delivering oxygen and taking care of patients with breathing tubes and ventilators and so forth. At one time, that was only done by nurses. And then there was a group of nurses who said, you know what, we could do this really well, and this could be just our specialty. And they sort of broke off and formed a profession or a group of its own. And they trained people in their schools and so on and so forth. That was the same thing for dietetics. At one time, there was no such thing as a dietitian in hospitals. It was all nurses who did that. Physical and occupational therapy started out as nursing and evolved and broke out into their own profession. Social work in hospitals was also the same thing. My point in all of this is that, you know, you can think of healthcare and healthcare work as a hierarchy, as a pecking order. Or you can sort of think of it as territory. Patients have needs that need to be met. And things, there are some boundaries around what different groups do, but they change over time. And it basically, which professions survive and thrive are the ones that do something that's really important and relevant to helping patients get healthy and stay healthy. So back to what nurses do. Using a scientific background, collaborating with other professionals and workers, and they build relationships with patients, or they work from a relationship that they built. And basically what they do is they help patients make the most of their potential for being healthy, including finding health within illness. You see patients sometimes who have big physical and mental health problems sometimes, really, really serious ones, and yet they find a certain degree of quality of life. You have patients who are at the end of life, and nurses and physicians and other disciplines, they figure out how to help patients get the best quality of life possible out of the last months, weeks, and hours of their lives. That is, you know, sort of fundamentally what nurses do. So that's the case in the critical care unit, which we talked about before, in medical surgical units, which are units where patients who don't actually need that constant attention. In an intensive care unit, there's never a nurse pretty much more than a hand's breadth away from a patient, ready to jump in and bring physicians to the bedside. On a medical or surgical floor, usually you'd see about four or five, sometimes even more patients for each nurse, but their conditions are often complex. There's often very interesting stuff going on. You see them in emergency departments. I know many of you have seen ER or episodes of Grey's Anatomy, and emergency departments are not a lot like that, actually, for the most part. Yes, there are traumas and emergencies and so forth, but emergency rooms are a lot about people who are not sure how sick they are waiting around, and the health professionals, nurses will be some of the first that you see, trying to sort out which patients need to be seen first and what order the patients need to be seen in. A statistical sort of factoid. About 60% of nurses either work in an ICU, an emergency room, or one of those medical surgical floors. Yes, there are nurses who work with pediatric patients, nurses who work in obstetrics and in psychiatry and so forth, and they're very important, but most nurses work in hospitals in one of those specialties. And, of course, the street nurses. And I really suggest you go look this up, you too. Bevel up. Really cool stuff. A little disturbing at times. Maybe your parents would be thrilled that you're watching this, but anyway. The home. I don't know if you guys had a chance to look up the readings that the organizers graciously put on the web. Great story from the New York Times about a program that's been, a set of programs actually, but the research that's been going on for decades about nurses who come into the homes of vulnerable families for social reasons, for economic reasons. Vulnerable families, the child is born, and nurses go and work with these families and help the mothers and fathers learn to take care of the babies, learn to get through the health transitions, and also help them cope with the stresses that are involved in having a young child. These interventions might not seem like a lot, but they're amazing. Read the article. They can track. These nurses spend time, sometimes home visits over months or years at the beginning of a child's life. 10 years later, when these babies are teenagers, they're staying in school, they're not getting into problems with the legal system, they are not becoming mothers and fathers themselves as teenagers. You can see distinctly measurable results. The nurses are bringing that relationship building to these people's homes. The people bring them in, welcome them in. They make good referrals. They understand a lot of things about what happens normally in families. They can reassure mothers and fathers and work with the kids. And the bottom line is they have this trusting relationship that develops. And when we take community workers who don't have a nursing background, they don't get any of these results. which is a fascinating thing. There is something about the background and the relationship building that the nurses do that seems to make an enormous difference. All right. So I'm not going to get to the squeamish slides quite yet, but I'll give you a little bit of background. So I'll give you one more concrete example. The title was called What Do Nurses Do Anyway? So I'm going to give you a specific example. As I mentioned, my spouse is a wound and skin care nurse. She specializes in the care of patients who have difficult-to-treat wounds. And one of the biggest things that she does, because she works mostly with patients who have illnesses, very serious illnesses that impair their mobility, and she works with them over months, weeks, months, years sometimes. And a big category that she gets into is what's called pressure ulcers or bed sores. And what I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes talks about protecting patients from the hazards of care. When something like bed rest seems like a great idea, I'm almost done. When something like bed rest seems like a great idea, turns out not to be such a great idea in the long term. This is a story about nurses assessing patients, implementing treatment, and supporting patients over the course of long and unpredictable courses. Couch potato. Rest is good. We all need to rest. We all need to recuperate from our long weeks of studying, working, or whatever, and we all need to rest. But fortunately, most of us, when we rest, we are moving. You know, we turn in our sleep. And we stay, even as a couch potato who doesn't move, we stay maybe for 6 or 8 hours. We don't stay there for days at a time. Not so much the case for hospitalized patients. One of the first things that we learn when we start to learn about technical nursing care is that staying in bed for long periods of time is bad. That's why you see nurses obsessed about getting patients out of bed and walking as soon as possible when they have surgeries, when they've come into the hospital for anything. Basically, every system of the body is negatively impacted by spending too long in bed lying. But the organ, and the skin is the body's largest organ, right? The organ that's most seriously affected by lying in bed for long periods of time is the skin. And basically, we have what we call bony prominences, and they're areas where the skin is in a rather thin layer right over a bone. And when we put against even something like a mattress, we lie something like a body part for long periods of time, eventually the circulation to that bony prominence is going to decrease. The body's ability to bring nutrients and oxygen and take it away decreases, and the skin can break down. And it can go all the way, the breakdown can go all the way to the bone. Close your eyes for a second, those who are squeamish. Oh, no, actually, that's not the squeamish part yet. I knew I was doing that. Anyway, so no matter what position the body is in, there are always these pressure points, sideways, sitting, lying, even in a wheelchair, not so hot idea. Now's the part where you might want to cover your eyes. This is a wound of a patient who came into my wife's practice, was being treated, and this is actually skin breakdown that happened because she was lying in bed for prolonged periods of time over a month in another hospital, and she came with breakdown. That yellow tissue there is called slough. It's dead tissue. It's actually covering something up. A month after, this is what the wound looked like, and actually this is good. This is actually good because that beefy red tissue is what they call granulation tissue. And it's an indication that the skin tissue is regenerating and the body is healing itself. There's less yellow tissue. If you look right in the dead center of the slide, you'll actually see that this wound goes all the way down to the bone. Yeah, but it's getting better. And it's better still here. Look at how nicely this is healed. So this is about 3 months into treatment. So this is many times a week changing this dressing. This is the body healing itself. What did they do? They made sure the pressure was relieved to this area of the body. They used correct dressings that would make sure that the skin could regenerate. And basically, they just sort of stayed and stayed with it. And this wound is almost healed. This is the same patient. The wound on the right side is the one that my wife was treating. The one on the left actually showed up during the hospital treatment because this lady, during her new treatment, because she was sitting in wheelchairs over time, so these wounds are always popping up whenever people are lying. But you can see that both of these wounds healed up really, really nicely. These are actually beautiful wounds. I know this sounds really crazy. These are beautiful wounds. So, really quickly, last few slides. Is there a nursing shortage out there? This is a really common question I get asked by people all over the place. If someone becomes a nurse, are they guaranteed a job? And the answer to the question, is there a nursing shortage, is it depends where and when we're talking about and what specialty. Can I guarantee you will automatically have a job if you come out of nursing school in a particular specialty in a particular city? Not necessarily. Right now, you might be hearing some stuff in the Montreal area that hospitals are not hiring as many nurses, but it's going to change in the next years because that average age of a nurse is 45. We have lots of retirements coming, and it is clear that nurses will play a big role in the future of healthcare. The thing to keep in mind, that evolution that I was talking about, roles and specialties and settings are going to change. Opportunities are going to be there, but they might not always be where nurses saw them in the past. What all those opportunities will have in common? A science base. Really important to have a strong science base to come into our profession. An ability to relate to people and work on teams. And a commitment to working to help people and communities stay healthy. Another question. Do nurses and doctors get along? Yes, they do. Extremely well in the majority of cases. Because when it comes down to it, everybody goes into this to help patients, and you realize pretty quickly, if you don't get along, good things aren't going to happen for patients. The drama, if you watch television series, is mostly the territory of soap operas and nighttime series. Again, people are under a lot of stress. Sometimes doctors and nurses don't get along. Sometimes doctors and doctors don't get along. Nurses and nurses. And sometimes family members are very upset and stressed and take it out on healthcare workers. But in general, things actually go really well. Why become a nurse? Top reason, if you're interested in people and serving society, that's any health profession. That's medicine, that's the rehab professions, that's pharmacy, that's all of them. There are some really interesting employment and advancement opportunities in nursing. I've had a really interesting career so far, and I probably have another 20 years to go, knock on formica or wood. This is an especially interesting field for folks who might like to try different things on a similar theme over time. I hope what I gave you in this presentation is a sense of what kinds of intellectual muscles that nurses use, which are the same in some ways, but a little bit different than those that some of the other health professions do. What to expect if you become a nurse? Well, I can tell you from my own experience and my family, interesting and varied reactions. Some very supportive, but it's kind of an interesting choice these days. Not a typical choice for men, and it's not even a typical choice for a lot of women these days. But people are mostly reliant on what they see on television, and you can't always believe what you see on television, right? It's something interesting to keep in mind. One of the things that's common to all the health professions is when you go into this training and you take on the responsibility of looking after other people, you make a transition from being a plain student or a layperson to becoming a health profession student, and then at some point, you're no longer the student or the trainee, and you are the nurse, the doctor, the pharmacist, or whatever. And those transitions are happening as you're actually growing up yourself. And sometimes there are bumps along the road, but it's a very interesting path to take. You'll grow over time. I'll also slide in here, I was thinking, what would be a useful thing to tell you guys about nursing education, just in case you were giving emotional support to one of your friends who went? The early part of a lot of university nursing education, they make a point of not doing much of the technical stuff that nurses are known for, that you see a lot in the media. And that's because the professors want the students to think big about the possibilities that are out there. The cool thing is that in a lot of cases, students finish a nursing education being aware of all kinds of opportunities that aren't there, and the folks that really wanted to go to the ICU eventually get to work in the ICU anyway. So to conclude, nursing is a health profession that's focused on the practicality of bringing care to the patient, to the public. It and the other health professions are evolving, and so is the healthcare system. Like the other health professions, it demands a knowledge of oneself, how you respond to things, what you're strong at, what you're not so strong at, and how you relate to people. It requires scientific knowledge and practical know-how about how to be as a person and how to do specific things. I hope I made the point that it's kind of important for consumers of healthcare and the other healthcare workers and professions to understand how each other works. It's amazing how even people who are working out in the field, how little we know about each other in the health professions. And finally, nurses help individuals, families, and communities become as well as possible and work with other healthcare professions to help patients get the best out of the healthcare system. And I would say, my little 5% plug recruiting pitch for the profession, I think for people with the right interests and talents who can be both optimistic about what we can do to help patients live good lives, but realistic at the same time about what life might throw at us, and can tolerate some fuzziness as all this is unfolding. Not only can nurses get the best out of the healthcare system for patients, but sometimes becoming a nurse can help us draw the best from ourselves. So thank you very much for your attention.
Lights, please. And a special thank you to Dr. Clark for a very invigorating talk and a wonderful overview. And those of you who have questions, put them down on cards. The students in red shirts will pick them up. There's some red-shirted students who are going to get up and pick up cards. And while the cards are being collected, I'm going to ask Dr. Clark to tell you in 2 minutes a little bit about his own research.
Okay.
Don't talk. Right.
Don't talk.
All right. Go.
Okay. The research that I do generally revolves around why some hospitals seem to get better outcomes for their patients than others. I study a lot of, Dr. Fuchs alluded to this, kind of accidents and errors in healthcare. So things like nurses injuring themselves on the job with used needles, patients getting the wrong medications, patients dying unexpectedly, but most importantly, how to prevent those kinds of things from happening. And not only how to educate nurses, sort of understanding what you need to teach nurses to keep them safe and keep the patients safe, but how you might need to manage things in a different way in terms of making sure the nurses, there are enough nurses with the right educations and so forth to do that. So I've studied hospitals, like hundreds of hospitals with my colleagues across countries, across provinces and countries. But sometimes I've also done studies where we've interviewed or observed nurses in motion doing various kinds of things in one particular hospital in one particular unit.
Okay, we have a lot of questions.
Okay.
Here we go. Strange. Two people wanted to know what is bad about nursing and what do you dislike about being a nurse?
Okay. Well, I think that nursing is, it's a practical, it's a hands-on thing, and so, and it involves people, and it involves dealing with people sometimes at their best, sometimes at the happiest moments of their lives, sometimes at the worst moments of their lives. And patients and families sometimes say and do really unpredictable things. In the end, it's a challenge, but it's a doable challenge to not take things personally. Sometimes, I think the worst part of nursing is being around people when you can't necessarily tune out the fact that they're just doing what they do because they're stressed, not as a personal thing.
We all have bad days. So, at least three students wanted to know on what part of the body was that bed sore.
Guesses! Anybody? The backside, the sacrum. Basically, that's a sacral area. So for those of you who know your bones there. Yes. So that woman, it was a woman, she had gotten that pressure ulcer by sitting, by lying in bed, and it was basically her back here that was in contact. She was also a lady who had diabetes, which made it more difficult for her to heal her wound and fight infections.
Okay, now we have some nitty-gritty questions. Very practical. Salaries for nurses, how
okay.
many hours? Now, these are important things.
Yes.
You know.
So, salaries vary a little from province to province. I'll tell you offhand, Quebec doesn't lead the list of the best paid nurses, but I can tell you in general, starting salaries for nurses are sort of in the $50,000 to $60,000 a year range, depending on where you are and so forth. Depending on, in a lot of cases, salaries are pegged to cost of living. You go to some big American cities, and yes, there are nurses in New York City making $100,000 a year, but if you try to get an apartment in the city or within reasonable commuting distance, are nurses overpaid? I wouldn't say necessarily. Do salaries go up when the shortages are deeper? Yeah, they do. But I would say that nursing offers salaries, for the most part, staff nurses who just had the basic training offer sort of solid middle-class salaries. Of course, if you become a specialist, the nurse specialists that are working, for instance, in our hospital system at McGill are working making around $80,000, $90,000 a year. Those are folks with master's degrees.
Whoever sent this question also sent some nice portraits. Including one of me. I'm delighted. You made me look younger. I'm very happy. Okay, now. This is the Betsor again. Oh, we've answered that one. The question is, what is the McGill mode of nursing, it says, or McGill model of nursing? How does it differ from other modes?
Interesting question.
Good, and then
I'll give you a thumbnail sketch answer to this one, because I could talk for an hour about it, but I promise I won't, because everybody has to go home. So the deal is, for about 3-4 decades, professors at McGill have really, in the School of Nursing, have really emphasized with their students, not only learning about those techniques and so forth, learning the sciences that underpin nursing care, but really emphasizing an approach to doing nursing care that's based on developing relationships with patients, finding out what patients want for themselves, and building from there. And the McGill model is generally about finding the strengths that are present in patients and families and using that as a basis for planning care, always involving patients as partners, patients and families as partners.
One question that many students, I'm sure, are asking, if you have to choose between nursing and medicine, what factors enter into that decision?
Well, off the cuff, and I'm not trying to be flip here, we're generally talking, it wasn't the case for me because you saw how much schooling I did, but that was my choice. Generally speaking, the schooling is shorter to become a nurse than it is to become a physician. Another thing to choose, depending on the depth of the science education that you want to go for and your success in those various science courses or the level that you're at in terms of, because getting into medicine is a very competitive enterprise in Canada and the States. Nursing is also an option for folks who are interested in doing this general kind of work, whose science grades may not be as high, but who have an interest in some of these other things that nursing emphasizes as well.
So I can contribute, if you don't mind. I had asked that question to a nurse when I was a patient, in fact, and said, why did you choose nursing over medicine? And she said, because I love to spend time with patients.
Right.
And she said what you said, that as a nurse, she spends almost all her shift of 8 hours or 12 hours looking after patients quite directly, whereas the physicians come in and see the patient and don't have the same continuity of experience with the patient. And that, I thought, was interesting.
It's a different kind of interaction.
Yep. Do nurses go to medical school? Where do they get their medical education, in other words, the material you talked about?
Well, generally speaking, I mean, there is no direct pathway from nursing to medicine. That doesn't exist. So, but at the same time, sometimes nurses along the way, and while they're doing their undergraduate degrees, pick up some of the courses that would be required to get into medical school. My understanding is that medical schools are not averse to considering members of other health professions who might be interested in coming in, but it's a very, very small percentage of nurses who ever go back for a medical education.
Right. But in our faculty here at McGill, the Faculty of Medicine includes the School of Medicine, School of Nursing, Physiotherapy, Occupational Therapy, and Speech Pathology. They're all part of the same faculty. And we do have increasing number of courses, which we call IPE, or interprofessional education, where doctors and nurses and, say, physiotherapists will learn together and study the same patient together. A patient with a stroke, for example, needs care by doctors, nurses, occupational therapists in the home, physiotherapists for rehab, and speech pathologists for speech, and also problems with swallowing, and that requires all of those professional streams. So there's a lot of interaction. If I wanted to become a nurse in pediatrics, how do I get there?
So we'd be talking here about a registered nursing education, one of those three paths that I was talking about. You don't actually specialize in your basic education, although sometimes you have the ability, every nursing student gets some sort of experience learning to care for children, whether that's in a hospital setting or whether that's in, you know, sort of community setting, sort of depends. But basically what nurses do in any specialty, if the question was, how do I get to be an emergency room nurse? How do I get to be an ICU nurse? Basically, when when you come out of school, you look for a job that's working in pediatrics or in the ICU or in the emergency room, or you find a way into that specialty over time. And generally, people's careers sort of evolve from there. A lot of people want to work in pediatrics. I've taught classes in nursing schools where it seemed like half of the students in the class wanted to do pediatrics. That's great, but sometimes they can't necessarily all do it right away. And also, interests evolve over time.
So here's an interesting question. Do nurses ever lose their patience? This is INCE, patience, when dealing with particularly unnerving patients? That's a good question.
And I think it's a really good question. I mean, I think one of the things from being in such close contact with patients, again, at their best and their worst, means that you get exposure to everything. Do nurses sometimes lose their patience? Yes. Not very often, though. Because part of the mark of a professional, basically, whether we're talking about a nurse, physician, pharmacist, or whatever, is the ability to be aware of oneself. You're sort of your own instrument. And you make sure that you are processing carefully what you're hearing and what you're saying back. And so generally speaking, you don't have situations where nurses have full-blown meltdowns, nuclear meltdowns in front of patients. That's pretty rare on average, and usually it's fairly extreme stuff.
Are there instances where nurses do research with doctors?
Absolutely. One of the things that's going on actually at McGill and in other universities is increasingly the teams that come together to study better ways to take care of different patient groups. They're composed of members that have a basic science background, sometimes a clinical science background, and often nurses can be part of a team, especially when it comes down to understanding how to organize care, how to deliver care, how to assess what the patient's experience and perspectives of things are, and so forth. So it absolutely does happen that that's the case. And more, instead of nurses sort of studying their own questions off to the side, what we do try and do is bring nurses into teams and teach them from the very beginning to do research like that.
Right. Is it easy to cope with work as a nurse and family life?
That's a great question. One of the things about hospital nursing, for instance, is that in terms of an erratic schedule, you know, something that can go days, evenings, nights, holidays, and so forth, it can cause some issues around family life, around social life, and so forth. That's part of the issue, I guess, that because patients in hospitals and in some other settings need care 365 days a year, somebody's got to be covering those patients one way or another, and nurses have to share that, just like physicians in a number of many specialties also have that going on. I think what the question might also be asking is, given everything you have to pour into your patients, NTS, do you have any patients, NCE, for your family at the end of the day? And I think that's something that you learn over time. It's not necessarily to turn it off, the things that you've seen and heard over the course of the day, but you learn to digest that stuff over time. As a result, what you'll see if you meet nurses, we've talked to a lot of nurses, they come in all shapes and sizes, but a lot of them have kind of philosophical attitudes towards life and don't get too excited about too much, especially after a few years in the field.
Keep cool. Nursing. When a patient enters, as you mentioned, Dr. Clark, an intensive care setting or is in a private room, does that mean that the patient will get more attention from nurses? And the follow-up is, how exactly do nurses help that particular patient deal with or prevent the emotional problems that you mentioned of isolation, ICUs with noise and beepers and all kinds of stuff?
So the first part of the question is, do patients get more attention if they're in a private room or if
right.
they're... So part of the deal that happens when a patient first comes into the hospital, and they might come in, for instance, from the emergency room or from the operating room, but basically somebody or multiple people have decided that a patient needs to come to the ICU, for instance, that a patient has just come after, come in after major heart surgery, for instance. And there's a lot of stuff going on, things are going to have to be kept an eye on, they're going to need a lot of medications and IV fluids and so forth, and that they need very, very close attention. So they come to the ICU. Or they come from the emergency room and they've just had, for instance, a cardiac arrest. They were successfully resuscitated, the way that always happens on medical shows. But in the short term, while we don't know if the patient's going to survive or not, they need a lot of attention and support over that period. So that attention and support is in line with how stable or unstable the patient is. That's what the deal. So we try and match. It's not just any patient that winds up in the ICU. It's the patients that need that intensity of nursing care. The second part of the question, how do nurses help patients deal with the emotional issues? Nurses get to know a lot about what patients are going to experience. So sometimes they're able to gently, quietly, subtly, sensitively explain to patients what's going on. In the ICU, most of the patients have a breathing tube down their throats and are unable to speak. That's kind of scary when you know that you're in a very serious medical condition and things are going on for you and you can't necessarily express yourself. Nurses find ways through the ways that they talk, they find alternate ways to communicate with patients, and they also have a sense of how to help the family members who come in communicate in an effective way even when words aren't necessarily possible or when things are very scary.
So here's a very important question. Are nurses always dependent on physicians?
No. My wife, those slides that I showed you with the pressure ulcer, That was basically, we're not going to say that there were no physicians involved in the healing of that wound, but that was basically all nurse who treated that pressure ulcer. There are circumstances, basically what Dr. Fuchs was talking about, there are circumstances where the expertise that's needed to help the patient comes from physical therapy or speech language or occupational therapy or comes from different specialties within medicine. There are times when what the patient really needs is a dermatologist, a skin specialist. That's what they need the most. But there are a lot of issues. There are a lot of things that nurses start on their own, continue on their own, and that they do almost independently of physicians. But, of course, when there are things the patients need in terms of drugs being prescribed for their illnesses, they need to help, we need to understand what specific illness the patient has, well, that's a little more medicine's territory, and then medicine comes into the picture.
One student wants to know how he or she can learn more about nursing. Is there some way to participate, get some experience of what it's like?
That's a great question. I'm going to date myself here, but I sort of came of age before the internet was a really big deal. And it is amazing when you go on the internet. Just be careful to make sure that your safe search is on. But if you put nurses or nursing in Google, it's amazing the stuff that you will pull up. And there are a lot of good films, documentary films about nursing, the practice of nursing. Discussion boards about people talking about why become a nurse, how nursing school works, and so forth. That would be one way. Talking to nurses. There's a lot of us out there. 300,000 licensed nurses in the country. In all likelihood, you know somebody in your family, or you can, through a brother or sister or whatever, you can find someone. That's a good way to do things. Volunteering in a hospital, excellent way to, or in another setting, in a community service, excellent way to actually meet a nurse, talk to her or him about his work.
Great. So, how to enter the profession, we've heard a lot. I want to thank Dr. Clark for a wonderful overview, answering a lot of important questions for all of us. Before you go, next week, Dr. Howard Steiger, again, a non-physician, a psychologist, who will talk about how to combine psychology, mental health, psychiatric care, nutrition, supportive care, and a lot of interesting insights in understanding and treating anorexia and bulimia nervosa. And those of you who will come will learn the meaning of all these little acronyms, DNA, TLC, or MTV, a mystery for next week. Thank you for being here. Safe travel home, and we'll see you next week. Take care.
Thank you.